Good morning. On this beautiful, beautiful day, I welcome you to the chance to pause and worship together. And to begin our time, I invite you to turn to the call to worship that's on the white sheet. Hopefully everyone can access one. I will read the leader and you will read the people. We gather as many individuals. We come from many places. We gather as God's children. We are one body in this place as God's church. Alleluia. And why don't you stand and join me in the worship book number 6 here in this place.
Our scripture this morning is from 1 Peter 2, verses 9 to 10. But you are a chosen race, a holy priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy.
We are delighted today to have Pastor Earl Zimmerman with us. Earl has been serving as pastor of Daniel's Run Peace Church up in Fairfax, Virginia, since 2013. Previously, he and his wife have been around the world, literally. They did an MCC term in Nepal, in India, where they were country regional representatives for India, Nepal, and Afghanistan. They also were with Eastern Mennonite Missions in the Philippines. And closer to home, he pastored at Shalom Mennonite, right down the hill, and was bivocationally teaching in the Bible department at our own EMU Bible and Religion department. He's a graduate from here, from EMS, also from Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminaries in Elkhart, and from Catholic University of America. His wife, Ruth, travels around the world working in relief and development for World Vision. And they are fresh back from a trip to India, which we might hear a little bit more about at lunch. They have three adult children and two twin grandchildren. And one of our family connections to Earl and Ruth is that when Daniel's Run Peace Church did a renovation and needed to be painted, they hired my husband Luke and our sons to go up there and paint, and they housed them and fed them, so they know stories about our family, which you can ask about. So Earl's title today for what he's sharing is God's Own People, Reimagining the Community of Jesus. Thank you, Earl, for being here with us.
Well, thank you, Carmen. I think our families also connect in some other ways. I was thinking, we never overlapped in the Philippines, but we both share that experience of working and serving in that country. It's just great to be back here. I have many fun memories of this place. I have many fun memories of the community and my time as a pastor here at Shalom Mennonite. And so it goes on and on. And I would say this, I just love that song. Somehow, I mean, to me, my what I'm talking about, being God's own people and reimagining the community of Jesus, is really about maybe having the courage to enter the song, but also to imagine, to reimagine, what it looks like. So according to scholars who track church membership, organized Christianity has been in a free fall in our country since the beginning of the century. It may be overly dramatic to speak of the end of religion as we know it, but we are certainly in the midst of what we might call the great religious recession. The storyline in the last decades of the 20th century was the decline of mainline churches, and that's the storyline when I was, in seminary or in graduate school. I was doing my doctoral studies at Catholic University during that time, and those were also tough times for Catholics who were dealing with a far-ranging clergy abuse scandal. Overall, Catholic membership was holding steady, at least if you looked at total church membership. But I remember one of my professors telling me, yeah, there's a secret in that. And he said, and that is it's holding steady because there's so many Hispanic immigrants coming from Central America, and that swells our numbers. He said, if you would really look at white and middle class membership, there's a precipitous drop. Now, in the 20th century, such dramatic decline in church membership cuts across the board, including evangelical churches and my own Mennonite denomination. Now, we could probably get into a discussion of the various reasons for that. I think a lot about it, and I'm tempted to go there, but I won't. That's not what I want to do today. You might want to ask me some things about that afterwards if we have a conversation. Instead, I'm lifting it out as the environment in which I took on the challenge of helping to turn around a small, struggling Mennonite congregation in Fairfax, Virginia. For you who are seminary students, and I don't know what you're planning, you're anticipating, pastoring a church, this is also going to be your world when you graduate and when you take that first pastorate. It can be a good challenge because, sometimes hard times are times of opportunity. It forces us to consider different ways of being the church. We don't just do the same old, because much of what we have been doing apparently isn't working. So we got to put on our caps and think, our thinking caps, and we need to have that courage and that imagination. The big question is how to be the community of Jesus in our environment. Focusing, and I think is one of the key problems, focusing on membership and numbers is self-defeating. It's like drawing up a business plan that focuses on the bottom line rather than on creating a valuable product. If all you're doing is saying, are we making money, losing money, you're in trouble. Christopher Smith and John Patterson, the authors of Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus, decry what they call our industrialized and McDonaldized approach to church. Now, think about that. This is what they say. Slow food and the other slow movements hold important lessons for the American church. They compel us to ask ourselves tough questions about the ground of our faith community, about the ground our faith communities have ceded to the cult of speed. And they invite all of us, clergy, theologians, and lay people, to start exploring and experimenting with the possibilities of slow church. Not as another growth strategy, but as a way of reimagining what it means to be communities of believers gathered and rooted in particular places and at particular times. And I think that last is the key to this. Being rooted in particular places and particular times as communities of believers. In the words of 1 Peter, the scripture that we read, what does it mean to be God's own people in our place and in our time? Well, for us, and my church in Fairfax, it means wrestling with what it means to be a church gathered and rooted in Fairfax, Virginia, part of the Old South. Our church is located on Old Lee Highway, and that tells us something, doesn't it? Slaves once worked the fields where our church is now located. During the Civil War, Union soldiers were billeted in a farmhouse up the street, and you can still go up there and see the graffiti they wrote on the walls with charcoal and their names and the regiments they were with. Today, Fairfax is one of the wealthiest counties in our nation, with an average household income of $114,000. As part of Metro DC, the U.S. government and the Pentagon drive the economy of our region. We're also one of the most ethnically and religiously, racially diverse regions of our country. People like me, from a Germanic Mennonite background, are few and far between. And that rules out creating a church primarily of my kind. You know, if I think I'm going to get people like me to come and be part of my church, just forget it. I mean, there's going to be some, but that's not going to work. So this is going to be an adventure. Perhaps out of necessity, we'll be able to break through some of those boundaries that have kept our American churches locked into particular people groups. You know, as a bit of gallows humor, the English writer Samuel Johnson once said, "Nothing concentrates the mind like the knowledge that you'll be hung in a fortnight." And I got that from George Brunk II. I don't know what class I was in once, and he told me that, and I've always remembered it. The way I want to relate that is churches have a life cycle of growth and decline similar to the life cycles of individuals. Decline and even death are a natural part of a church's life cycle. Churches can, however, renew themselves and experience a new lease on life. I say this because facing death can make us take the necessary risks to reinvent ourselves. So that gallows humor kind of fits in there. All right, we're going to die unless we do something big and serious. When I became the pastor of our church 5 years ago, we were in serious decline, having lost quite a few families, and we're down to a regular attendance of 10 or 15 people. I remember them inviting me to come over and say, "Earl, would you come and preach a sermon?" And I said, "Well, okay. Do you want to be our pastor?" "Well, I don't think so." But now here I am, you know. The reason I actually did it was because those remaining people were determined and deeply committed. For example, I'm going to give one example, I could give others. John Cleaver, who was our church council chair, was 90 years old. I said, 90-year-old council chair? Come on, you know. But he was an amazing guy, and I soon found it out. He's a retired entomologist who had worked for the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, he had actually retired several decades before that. And before that, he had served in the U.S. military And I remember him telling me, he said, you know, Arlie said there's a lot of pacifists buried in Arlington Cemetery. He said, they came upon their pacifism the hard way. And he was a determined man who enjoyed life and didn't give up easily. And he would show up at my church office every Tuesday. It was just like clockwork. I knew he would be there. And we went out to lunch together. And together, we schemed about how to revive the church. And we had a lot of good years, several good years together. Well, John died last year after a very quick struggle with lung cancer. And I still miss him. And sometimes Tuesday morning, I think, oh, man, you know, John's not going to come. I was committed to helping our church die a good death if that became inevitable. I think some people have to do that, too. Yet, I was determined to do everything I could to help us find a new lease on life. There's no three-step method to church growth. We can't franchise church growth like you franchise a fast food restaurant. There are, however, several things that need to happen. The first is getting rooted in the community. A plant can't grow unless it's rooted, and the same is true for churches. You have to get rooted. And so I had, my wife Ruth and I at that point had lived in the other side of Washington, D.C., and in Hyattsville, in Maryland, and we said, well, if I become a pastor of this church, I need to move to Fairfax. And Ruth said, okay, that's good, you know, and we did. I had to move there because so that I could get involved in our local community. And among other things, I became active in a group working for affordable housing. And just to say this, too, none of these things means that, okay, now people are going to come to our church next week. No, it's me. It's me learning to know the community, knowing what people are struggling with, knowing their joys and their concerns, and me getting rooted in the community. And then also, we become known in the community as well. And I also joined the Interfaith Clergy and Leadership Council, and I became a master gardener, among other things, you know. The other thing I did was I embraced smaller churches. You know, every church is the right size for who we are. Our American culture is full of sizeism, and we need to resist it. The early church was a whole network of small house churches. There was a time when that's just what the church was. Furthermore, 2/3 of Protestant congregations in the U.S. have less than 100 members. But it's the mega churches that catch our attention. Carl Dudley, who writes on church about church, says this. He says, in small churches, most people know most people and know more people than in most larger congregations. When compared to other kinds of caring groups, the small church is much larger than it ought to be. Now think about that. It's much larger than it ought to be. When church is measured by human relationships, the small church is the largest expression of Christian faith. Because of the whole size of us in our culture, we have a problem with our own self-perception. You know, we're just a small church. You know, no, we are a small church. And of course, one of the big challenges for small churches is paying a pastor's salary, and we can be creative about that. You know, our church is able to pay me a 3/4 time salary, and sometimes they're very apologetic. They say, "Earl, you know, we're sorry, you know, but the truth is, I love it. I absolutely love it. It gives me one day a week to pursue other avocations, such as my gardening and my writing. And if I take off, I say, well, I'm only 3/4 time, you know, and the other thing about it, too, is, of course, it also depends on my wife, Ruth's salary and the work that she does, and we put it together. And of course, we're in a place in our life where we're not sending children to school or praying for, and so it makes it much more possible. But I think there's other ways of making it possible. So you have to put it together and think about it, and come up with some kind of creative financial arrangements. Another huge opportunity and challenge we have had is our church property. And lots of churches have this problem. We have a big building that looked old and tired when I came. And I still remember walking into that thing that first Sunday I saw it. I said, oh man, this has got to change. Furthermore, the other thing is our worship space was actually on the third floor. And that's a long story. I won't tell you why it was there. I don't have time now, but that's where it was. But the other part of it is that we had almost 3 acres of land in the city of Fairfax, right in the middle of the city of Fairfax. Most of it was on a floodplain with a woods and a small stream called Daniel's Run that was flowing through it. So we began to dream and to scheme about that. Those were some of the things that I ended up talking with about John Cleaver when he came to meet with me. We first created a nature trail through our woods with the help of a local Eagle Scout troop. So that game was okay. That didn't mean much, but it kind of rooted us in our place. He said, wow, you know, this is what we are. And it gave our members a new appreciation. We're sitting on a valuable piece of real estate. And because of that, we were able to leverage it to do the remodeling in our church that was needed, to move our sanctuary to the ground floor, completely remodel it, and make it handicapped accessible. We rent out our church space to 3 different church groups, which together more than cover our mortgage. So it's actually making money for us. Not big time, but it does. One church, Table Covenant Church, is especially interested in Anabaptist theology. And we're getting to do more and more things together. Mike Han, the Korean-American pastor, and I have become good friends. I mean, they have their office in our building, and we often hang out together, and we meet other people there, and it becomes that kind of a place. And one of their church staff is now in charge of our children's program. And more we're talking about and doing, holding joint worship services and doing certain things together several times a year. The next one's going to be our Easter morning service. We said, you know, it's not fun being a small church on Easter morning. It's like that. We need a big group. We said, let's all come together and do Easter morning together. And so you can do things like that. The other significant thing we have done is working at a long-range planning and at visioning. Child care, environmental protection, and creating a spiritual home in our fast-paced urban environment. Part of that, we also said, well, okay, let's identify several aspects of who we are. First, we said, we're a small, diverse church that welcomes everybody, no matter who you are or what your background may be. Second, we're a spiritual home for people who are finding faith for the first time, as well as for those who, because of past hurtful experiences, are best described as church refugees. When I say that, I can think of certain people and certain faces in our congregation and say, yeah, that's who they were and that's who they are. And then the third one is we're a peace church shaped by our Anabaptist spiritual ancestors and rooted in the life and the vision of Jesus. Finally, we embody a faith-based social concern that includes the poor, those on the margins of society, and our threatened natural environment. As we were working at this, several of us came up with a bright idea of changing our name to better fit our vision. And our former name was Northern Virginia Mennonite Church. It didn't quite seem to communicate that vision. Northern Virginia is a huge area. It would be a bit like calling ourselves the Shenandoah Valley Mennonite Church. And you'd say, well, what is that and where is that? You know, we decided to instead go local and draw on the name of that little stream meandering through our woods, Daniel's Run. It tied us to our neighborhood. It tied us to our watershed. Some of us are very interested in watershed kinds of things, and so that just seemed to fit. Next, we debated what to do about our denominational name. Now, this might be a bit controversial. I don't know. In Fairfax, where we live, many people don't know what Mennonite means. And it seems like we say we're Mennonite, and they kind of look at you, and they say, what does that mean? Or they think of us. I know one time one of the city administration people said to me, you're kind of insular, aren't you? Are other people welcome there? I said, whoa. You know. So some people who do know, kind of, they say, oh, yes, you're a peace church, aren't you? I said, yes, that's right. We're at one of the historic peace churches. And so we said, so let's put that front and center. And we became Daniel's Run Peace Church. Now, our Green MC USA logo fits perfectly. We said, why, we love that. We love that dove. And it's even colored green for the environmentalists among us. And so we'll put that on our, you know, on our logo as well. And an underlying issue is thinking, an underlying issue I think that's a part of this is, oh, the other thing I should say, though, too, is we do, you know, on our website identify ourselves as a congregation of Mennonite Church USA. And the underlying issue with that is a denominational identities. You know, we could talk about that. What, you know, denominations were something that were invented in the 19th century in North America. In what way do they have to be reshaped? In what ways have they run their course? In what way do they have to be reinvented and reimagined as well? Especially in our era that Daniel Butler Bass identifies as the end of church and the birth of a new spiritual awakening. Finally, we decided to create a church motto. One young woman suggested living the love, she said. And then another young man who's a permaculture advocate suggested, well, we need to talk about justice, but let's call it growing justice. Not only doing it, growing it. Others added that it should include welcoming everyone. So we came up with living love, growing justice, welcoming everyone. Now, I don't know how important that is for appealing to outsiders or people that are interested in our church. I think it is. But just as important, it gives us our own identity. You know, we ourselves say, oh, yes, that's who we are. We're still a small church. We love that identity, even though being 30 people feels much better than being 15 or 20 people. Our biggest growth has been in children. And as a pastor, that's a good thing. When the kids start coming, when the children start coming, it's because their parents are bringing them, and then after a bit, I know how that works. And so that's great. When I became the pastor of our church 5 years ago, we had only one grade school child and two teenagers who were definitely there under duress, and they were on their way out. Today we have 8 children who attend regularly and several more who come occasionally. So we're now starting another long-term planning committee. And this is a kind of a different one. Our young people are all eager to be part of it. And that's a healthy sign. The committee, which we were thinking about, first we were thinking about 6 or 8 people on our committee, and then more and more people said they would like to be part of it, and now we're up to 10. And I joked, and I said, well, okay, let's get 2 more, and we're an even dozen disciples. And I plan to retire in 2 years. And in about a year from now, the committee will begin succession planning. Actually, they may be beginning it as we meet. And then it's going to become a pastoral search committee. And then we're going to be on into our new adventure of being our church in our place in our time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Earl. You've given us a lot to think about. I particularly like the image of sort of thinking about church in the crock pot instead of the McDonald's drive-thru. You talked about the slow cooker image. I'll tell a story that will embarrass myself. Right before chapel began, Earl and I were chatting, and he was sharing with me some of what he was going to talk about and the strength of small churches. And I said, yes, I'm all the time telling my youth ministry students that numbers are not where it's at, but you know, and trying to encourage people to not have low self-esteem about being small. And then I proceeded to explain to him the reasons that chapel attendance is small, and he shouldn't take it personally if there weren't that many people here. And I realized that I had just done what I had just said that we need to not do. Anyway, but I only realized it because he pointed it out to me. Yeah. So I think it's definitely one thing to know in our heads that numbers are not everything and small is fine. But it is easy when we're in leadership of something that small to not compare and to not look at the church down the street that has the bells and whistles and the exciting programs and hundreds of people. And so I think it's a spiritual discipline to be reminded. You had this line, every church is the right size. And I think that is the line that I'm going to use to sort of close this time of sharing, but to let you all know that we do have lunch. We have Lenten lunches on Tuesdays, and so we have lunch following, and Earl will be there and able to answer questions and continue this dialogue. So I wanted us to take a moment to pray today for our sister Nancy Heisey, our associate dean. Most of you know that yesterday her husband Paul Longacre passed away after years and years and years of battling leukemia. And so we want to be remembering Nancy, their daughters, Kara and Marta, and the extended family. So would you join me in a time of prayer? Lord, you are the giver of life, and we pray in gratitude for the faithful life of Paul and for the faithful witness of Nancy as she has journeyed with him through these many years of illness. We are grateful for a peaceful end to his journey, and we are grateful for knowing that he is with you. We do pray now for Nancy and Kara and Marta and the extended family as they journey this season of grief. Would you join me now in a benediction, number 763 in the back of the hymnal? Please stand. We came to worship.
We know how to serve.
We have been given the light.
We know how to
shine. We have been blessed by God's love.
We know how to share.
We are Christ's disciples. Go in peace and join us for lunch.